On September 23, 2007, New York Senator Hillary Clinton came to Charlottesville's Paramount Theater to raise money for her presidential campaign. She was interviewed by Albemarle County resident and best-selling author John Grisham for about an hour before the floor was open to questions from the audience.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I am not running, so knock it off. Welcome. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Paramount. Thank you, folks, for coming. Thank y'all for writing checks to help pay for what we know is a very expensive campaign. In spite of the record sums of money being raised, still less than 1% of all registered voters actually contribute. So we thank you for being here. What we're going to do, we have Hillary, as I was told to call her, what you call her, Mrs. First Lady or Senator or whatever, Hillary. She's going to be here for about an hour on stage. She and I are going to talk for about 45 minutes or so, and then she wants to take questions from the audience. And we have four mics downstairs and two up, so she really enjoys doing that. I would be terrified to do that, but she wants to do it. And that's the way we'll end the evening. There's one person I want to thank for this event. When we announced it a couple of months ago, I was asked several times, how did you get Hillary to come to Charlottesville? And I didn't know it then, but Obama's coming to Charlottesville. Everybody comes to Charlottesville, okay, because we're so important here. But Hillary has a friend by the name of Linda Zecker, who they met back during her senatorial campaigns. And I can't really take any credit for getting Hillary here because all the credit goes to Linda Zecker. And Linda, would you stand up and take a bow? I have never done this before, moderate a conversation. As homework, I watched some of the professionals on television. I'm not sure I learned what to do, but I learned what not to do. I will not rudely interrupt Hillary. Like Chris Matthews. I will not fall asleep like Larry King. I will not remind her of things she said to the contrary 25 years ago, like Tim Russert. Oh, it's kind of funny when he does that. And I will not issue or spew forth idiotic, vitriolic garbage like Mr. O'Reilly. Beyond that, I'm not sure what we're going to do, but we're going to have some fun. It will come as no surprise to most of you that tomorrow is September the 24th. And one year ago tomorrow, we were on this stage for an evening with best-selling authors, raising money for Jim Webb. Stephen King came to town. Jim Webb was here. We all three read from our books, and we spoke, and we had a wonderful evening. We raised $200,000. The place was packed. And 5 weeks later, when we voted, Jim Webb carried 33 out of 38 precincts in this town and this county. His margin of victory was 10,000 votes, and that turned out to be his margin statewide. And because of this, we have aggressively and shamelessly taken full credit for his... and because of this, that event sort of has taken on some notoriety in political fundraising circles. Other politicians have called us for similar events. John Edwards called, and we gave him Stephen King's phone number. A few months ago, Jim Gilmore called. And He said he was running for president. We said, you got to be kidding. Yeah. He didn't know it was a different party. He didn't know it was the wrong side. John McCain called. And we suggested he just ease on down the road to Lynchburg. We could probably find a better audience. I'm not going to go through all 24 of them, okay? Enough of that. When Hillary called, we said, let's have a party. So would you please welcome the lady from New York, Hillary Clinton. Cushion work.
Yeah, the cushion works for me.
Cushion back. Welcome to the Paramount Theater.
It
in
is
Charlottesville, Virginia.
Thrilling to be here. John and I were talking before we came out about how much we love these old theaters that have been saved, preserved, and transformed. And this is a beautiful example of that. So congratulations to everybody who had anything to do with it.
First question, I read your autobiography. I did my homework for tonight. There's a lot of books out about you. Have you noticed
I've noticed that, yeah.
Have you read those books?
No.
Don't?
Mm-mm, no. I've read your books.
Don't, well.
You know, I think for interest of full disclosure, we ought to just go ahead and tell everybody that my husband and John are like 17th cousins, twice removed. So I don't think that means he goes easy on me, but it does mean we know where to find him in the event that he does it.
Bill Clinton's father was a man named Lim Grisham.
Grandfather.
Grandfather.
Right.
And, of course, we're all born in Arkansas. And sooner or later, everybody there is pretty much related. And
that's what...
In fact, when he first took office, he had kinfolks popping up everywhere.
Yes, he did. You know, run for president, you find relatives you never knew you had. We were happy when we found out through some genealogist that there was somebody who had actually done well in life that we were distantly related to.
Or if you want to meet a lot of your kinfolks, write a couple of bestsellers.
And I bet that works, too.
They all write you. And they're almost all of them are broke, which is very... You've been to Charlottesville several times.
I have been.
The famous trip was in 1993 when you guys were going from Little Rock to D.C. to assume office, and you detoured here.
Right.
What was that all about?
Well, we had talked a lot about what Bill wanted to do as president, and, of course, one of his favorite presidents was President Jefferson. And he wanted to start this journey to the inauguration at Monticello, and so we did. We began that morning and had a wonderful gathering with people. But in part it was also because a few years earlier in 1989, there had been an educational summit that had been held here at the university, and it was exciting because there was a dinner at Monticello. And I think it was the historic significance as well as the wonderful memory of that event that persuaded Bill we would start at Monticello and really think about what was required for this time in American history. And, of course, that's what you have to do in America. You have to keep reinventing our country and keep moving toward the future, and yet you don't want to lose all the values and the importance of the past. So it was kind of melding it together.
Well, speaking of Virginia, we have not voted for a Democrat since 1964.
I heard that.
Now, I bet you more than heard it. I bet you've analyzed it. Although, we've had back-to-back Democratic governors. Mm-hmm. Jim Landslide Webb took
That's
over
right.
last year.
That's right.
Mark Warner's running for the Senate, and he's going to be very hard to
Absolutely.
Beat. I mean, so thank you. I mean, I've talked to your staff enough to know that you guys have a plan for pretty much everywhere. Tell us how you can put Virginia in play and win Virginia.
Well, I think that what Jim Webb did, what Tim Kaine did, what Mark Warner did, is very exciting, because I don't think people in Virginia are satisfied with the direction of our country. And there are a lot of Republicans and independents in Virginia, as elsewhere, who are anxious to turn the page and move on to the kind of American agenda that makes sense, you know, really rolling up our sleeves and trying to solve our problems. And if you look at Virginia, it is still a reach for any Democratic presidential candidate. But I think that Senator Webb is doing a superb job, and I believe that Governor Warner will become Senator Warner, and that will be in 2008. So if we put together a positive agenda that makes sense to people in Virginia, that tries to get beyond all the divisiveness that has unfortunately marked our politics and I think undermined our capacity to really get the job done in America, it could be that Virginia would be competitive. And I'm not ceding any part of America. I think we want to work around the country, bringing people together. That's what I did in New York. I worked just as hard in upstate New York, which was very Republican, as I did in New York City, because I said to people I wanted to be the senator for the entire state. I didn't want to say, well, I will just represent this part of the state and these kinds of voters. And that's what I'm doing running for president. I want to be a president who tries to bring our country together. And obviously, I hope to do well. And, you know, maybe if everything works out right, even put Virginia back into a winning column for a Democrat.
We hope so.
Well, if you win Virginia, we'll take credit for it here. And
it starts right here, just like, you know, Bill's trip to the White House started
with you,
in Monticello.
If we can win you and Webb, we're going to take this show on the road.
That's a good show to take.
History is full of former presidents who write about leaving the White House, and there's almost unanimously this sense of exhilaration, just the thrill of getting out of it, because it's such, I mean, it is a tough job.
And it is.
And why do you want to go back?
Well, when you put it like that. well, probably I have seen in a unique way what is possible in our country and what a president can do and the limits of what a president can do. It's a tough job, and it is an exhausting job, and it's probably become more so simply because of all the pressures we have in the world and the 24/7 media environment and everything that, you know, just puts an enormous burden on the one person that we have in the White House. You know, most countries have a head of state, you know, like a president or a king or a queen, and then they have a head of government. Well, we don't do that. We have one person. So it's a very challenging job, but I know we can do better. I mean, I have watched with some amazement and deep frustration what has happened in our country the last 6.5 years. It is not the America that I grew up in. It is not the America that I was raised to believe in. It has been, in my view, a dangerous experiment in extremism. And I think we have to take our country back. And I believe that given my experience, I can do that.
I want to follow up on that, because that was sort of the next series of questions. When you guys left the White House in January of 2001, there was relative peace in the world, relative prosperity, record surpluses, which sounds unbelievable now. We were admired. Even after 9/11, we had a tremendous amount of sympathy. The question is now, how did we blow it? I mean, it's hard to be optimistic now about so many aspects of our culture, society, and our political front, but also around the world, we're almost uniformly despised.
Well, it gives me a great deal of sadness that, you know, after 9/11, we did have the world behind us. And, you know, as a senator from New York, I was deeply touched by people turning out all over in places that now we forget. One of the biggest demonstrations that was pro-America in sympathy was in the big square in Tehran, Iran. And we took that goodwill and that historic opportunity to begin to build the post-Cold War era. Because yes, we faced lots of serious challenges, but we had a moment in time where the world was behind us, and that has unfortunately been squandered. And we squandered also, as John says, our budget surplus, our balanced budget, which gave us the resources to deal with a lot of our long-term problems. So we have gone from, yes, as you've described it, problems, no doubt about it, but we were on a trajectory of progress, and we were preparing ourselves for the 21st century in that way that Americans do, constantly looking over the horizon into the future that we want to create. Well, unfortunately, President Bush had a very different set of beliefs about what he should do as president. You know, after 9/11, I waited for the president to summon us to some sense of service and sacrifice. That's happened in previous times in our country, and it didn't happen. You know, I don't think the president asked us to do anything except go shopping. And that was hardly up there with all we have to fear is fear itself. It didn't inspire what is best about America. And then when you look back and you think that there have been two overriding objectives during this administration, one, tax cuts for the wealthiest of Americans, and the other, the war in Iraq, neither of which have been paid for. In effect, it's being put on the credit card and passed on to the next generation. So I don't think that we've been well served in the last 6.5 years. And increasingly, people of all political persuasions have reached the same conclusion. Now, what does that mean? I think it means we've got to have a serious election, an election that really does help a president chart a future. You know, not only what we need to do to restore our position around the world, but also to begin to address the challenges, health care, the economy, education, so much else here at home. But I think America's up to it. I mean, people say to me, a variation on what John said, I mean, why would you ever do this? And I guess it's because I don't want to be part of the first generation of Americans to leave our country worse off than when I came into this country. As a child who inherited the sacrifice and service not only of my family, but of the generations of America before. You know, Ken Burns is about to launch his World War II series. And we talk about the greatest generation, but there was a lot that is incredibly commendable about that generation, as there were with previous generations, going back to those from Virginia who helped to design this system that we are part of. Well, what is our obligation today to keep faith with all that came before? And I think we can turn it around, but we've got to start. I don't want to see us continue to drift away from our values and our founders' idea of what our system should be as it continued to evolve over time. So I want an election that's really a serious election and not get diverted into all the sideshows that too often move us away from the kind of conversation we should have. One of the things that I admired about Jim Webb's campaign is he stayed very focused on Iraq and the economy, two overriding issues that he is working to address, that those of us who are with him in the Senate are trying to tackle, but that's what we have to do nationally.
Thank you. You mentioned the greatest generation. It was before that generation, and even two generations before that generation, when the Chicago Cubs last won the World Series.
That's such ancient history.
You're serious. You're really a Cubs fan.
I was born and raised a Cubs fan. And I have been able to remain a Cubs fan because I also became a Yankees fan. And now, this is a serious...
You can boo if you want to.
Yeah, he's going to try to get that. You're talking about real baseball, and this is a great psychological insight into me. You know, I know the press is always trying to figure me out. Well, I will tell you as long as you don't tell anybody else.
It's safe in here.
Yeah, it's safe in here. My family were were big Cubs fans, my father, my brothers, and I. But when I was about, oh, I guess 8 or 9, I realized that it was kind of hard being a Cubs fan. You know, every year the same hopes would rise and be dashed. And we'd have these long conversations over breakfast or dinner about how this year would be different. And, you know, we would be glued to the TV set, WGN, you know, watching those games. And then our hopes would be dashed again. And I realized that if I was going to remain a Cubs fan, I had to also find an American League team that would win. And I saw a television program in probably, oh my gosh, 1955, 59, 56, 57, somewhere around there, about Mickey Mantle's life. And I just thought Mickey Mantle was it. And so I began following the Yankees and the Cubs. And it really gave me a psychic balance that I have found extremely useful in my life. You know, one foot in hope, another foot maybe next year. So, yes, I have remained that. And I understand, just as Bill, having been born in Arkansas, you are a St. Louis Cardinals fan. A very lonely position to be in. But I know.
We won the World Series last year,
That's true. That's true. It's not exactly what you'd call a dynasty, but there is something to, you know, to hold on to, some hope there.
If you want to get ugly about it. There are a lot of people who said you became a Yankees fan when you ran for the U.S. Senate from New York. I didn't say that, but a lot of people did.
I know. And then my mother, bless her heart, found a picture of me from Halloween in probably 1957 wearing a Yankees uniform with number 7 on it. And then, in case there was any further doubt, pictures of me wearing a Yankees cap before my husband became president. Now, I understand how I can be accused of all kinds of things. But being accused of only becoming a Yankees fan for political purposes cut to the core. And I rarely respond to criticism. I figure, well, you know, there's so much of it. How can I take my time responding to it? So I just sort of let it go on. But this was personal. And then everybody started saying, well, that's impossible. Why, you know, if you're living in Chicago, why would you even follow the Yankees? Well, because you can't be a White Sox fan. I mean, it's like you can't be a Mets fan if you're a Yankees fan. I mean, those are some things that are just not done. And so all of my friends that I grew up with, you know, they were ready to, like, sign affidavits. This got really serious. You know, calling people up and saying, well, we were, you know, pick one. We were a White Sox fan and a Mets fan or some other combination. Well, I am a proud Cubs and Yankees fan. However, I will say that the prospect, since the Cubs will be in the playoffs and it looks like the Yankees will be in the playoffs, the prospect of a Cubs-Yankees World Series does concern me, because I think that is probably somewhere in the book of Revelations. I think that, that is probably a sign of the coming apocalypse, because it is so otherworldly. But if it happens, we will go.
I wouldn't worry about it.
I knew you'd say that.
One of the great things, and this is the last cheap shot on that, one of the great things about being a Cardinal fan is to watch the Cubs collapse every year in September. So, this is going nowhere. Let's just move on. Let's talk about the environment. This is a pretty hot topic for Central Virginia. You see where we live. It's a beautiful part of the world, and we're very proud of it, and we do things like we recycle at an alarming rate around here. It's very green. Growth issues are always at the forefront of any election around here. But on a national scale, a much larger scale, what is the most crucial environmental issue that our country faces?
Global warming. And I think it's finally broken through on the public consciousness that it's a real problem. We cannot deny it, And we have to change our energy policies and our environmental policies to begin to deal with it. And there are added benefits for doing so. You know, in New York, and I don't know about the coast here in Virginia, but in New York, a lot of homeowners are having their homeowners insurance canceled because insurance companies have done these long-term weather projections, and they foresee increasing and more intense storms. So they've gone back to homeowners, and they say, okay, fine, we're going to up your rates dramatically, or we're not even going to offer in this area. So it's not just a Gulf Coast phenomenon. It's in Florida. It's on Long Island in New York. So it's no longer just about the tragedy of potential loss of ice cap and the species like the polar bears and everything we've been following. It is really about what's going to happen here. And in other parts of the world, the effects are pretty obvious. You know, the creeping desertification in Africa is one of the reasons for a lot of the conflict that seems so endemic now. And we can look across the globe and, you know, point to problems that are related to this increase in greenhouse gas emissions. Now, I think once we agree that we have a problem, we've got to roll up our sleeves and figure out how to address it. And I think we know more about what to do. We have to move toward a new energy policy, not only because of global warming, but also because of security. We cannot continue to import the amount of foreign oil that we do and export the billions of dollars to regimes that are unstable, many of which turn around and use our money against us. And there are a number of things. We can become more energy efficient. You know, energy efficiency would move us a considerable way toward reducing our dependency. I believe that if we had a commitment to making our buildings, our houses, our commercial buildings, our public buildings more energy efficient, that would be a good start. We need new clean energy technologies, and we have to go at it with the same level of support that we did with the Apollo project. And a number of us have ideas about how best to do that. We have to clean up the fossil fuels that we use. We are going to continue to use coal, but we've got to figure out how to sequester the carbon and try to do everything possible to make it less polluting and less damaging to the atmosphere, not only here, but around the world. In India and China that are developing so quickly, we've got to help them and work with them. All of this is doable, not overnight, but in a way that doesn't undermine our economy. The debate has been, you know, very stale, kind of, brain dead, if you will. I mean, the debate has been, we've got to do it. The other side says, no, we can't. We'll wreck the economy. I think we can actually create millions of new jobs through a new energy agenda and dealing with global warming. And there's a lot of evidence of that around the world. So.
Thirteen years ago, you and your husband launched a radical plan to ensure that every American has quality health care. And you got beat up.
Mm-hmm.
You got beat up by the insurance industry, by the health care providers, by the drug companies. I mean, it was really ugly. Where are we 13 years later?
Well, I hope we're at the brink of a consensus among business and labor and doctors and nurses and hospitals and families and the government that we have to change our healthcare system, but do it in a way that keeps faith with what people like about our system, but changes what doesn't work. You know, what I have proposed this week is very different from what we proposed back in 93 and 94. I learned a lot of lessons back then, and I'm going to put those to work when I'm president to finally get to where we need to go as a nation, because all the problems we were talking about in 93 and 94 have gotten worse. We have many millions more of uninsured Americans, and we have this new phenomenon that is increasing, the number of people with insurance who are told the insurance company won't pay for what they need. You know, as a senator, I see that all the time. I mean, I will get a call from a man in northern New York, and he'll say, what have I done wrong, Senator? I've worked for the same employer for a number of years. I've always paid my premiums. My family was healthy. Now my son has been diagnosed with a rare disease, and the doctors say there's one place in the country where he should go. Insurance company says they won't pay for it. Or a mother from Long Island who will tell me that her daughter's been diagnosed with leukemia and needs a stem cell transplant, and the insurance companies put the family in kind of a catch-22. They'll pay for the stem cell transplant, but they won't pay for the donor search. And the mother says, you know, we're a family of modest means. We can't afford this. So I argue with the insurance company, and my staff goes to work, and usually the insurance companies, under that kind of pressure, back down and reverse themselves on those individual cases. But there are millions of cases like this. And I don't think it is right that someone has to go to their senator to get the insurance that they thought they had paid for when they really need it to take care of their son or their daughter or another family member. So what... So what I want to do is expand the number of choices that Americans have and make them affordable. So the plan that I have put out there is called the American Health Choices Plan. And if you are happy with what you have, you keep it. No changes whatsoever. But if you're uninsured, one of the 47 million who are uninsured, or if you are underinsured in the sense that you have insurance but it doesn't pay for what your doctor says you need, you will be able to go into the congressional plan. You know, the Congress pays for health care for federal employees, including members of Congress. And there are over 250 choices. And they are, on average, less expensive than what you can find through your employer, and certainly less expensive than if you have to go into the individual market. So we're going to open that plan up to every American. And even employers will be able to go into that plan to get a better deal. And if there are still affordability issues, we're going to offer health care tax credits so that individuals will be able to afford it, and also to small businesses. Because one of the lessons that I learned was that small businesses, about slightly less than half, offer health insurance today. Many of them literally cannot afford to do so. So if you mandate a small business to do that, which was part of what we were looking at back in 93 and 94, we will undermine the main source of job creation in America today, because 80% of the new jobs in America in the last 15 years have come from small businesses. So instead, I'm going to provide a health care tax credit. And again, small businesses will no longer be on their own and have to worry about these exploding costs. They'll also be able to go into this health choices menu that will be provided. We will also have a public plan option. You know, a lot of people said, well, why don't we just go to single payer? And there are people who really believe that it would be more efficient and more effective. I don't think that Americans want government-run health care. They do want the government to regulate the quality and the cost of health care. That's why we will regulate the insurance companies in a way that forces them to compete on quality and cost. But they will no longer be able to deny people coverage because you have a pre-existing condition. I mean, if you're a diabetic, that's what you need health care coverage for. And I think... I think it'll still be hard, but there is so much greater awareness today among all of us about how we've got to get costs down. Premiums have gone up, you know, 90% in the last 6 years, and it's just not sustainable, and we can do more on quality, and I think we can cover everybody. So I'm actually looking forward to the debate. It was tough last time, but I think that there's a growing commitment in the country to do this.
Last week I was talking to a lady named Connie Brennan, who's running for the House of Delegates. She's one of us. She told me she was knocking on doors in Nelson County, in a pretty rural part of the county. And we were talking. I said, what are the people, what do they want to talk about? And, you know, is it the war? Is it immigration? What are the hot issues? She said, it's all health care.
Yeah.
It's health care.
Yeah.
And that's your issue.
It
you
is.
You can't let anybody trump you on this, okay?
Well, they won't, because, you know, I've been committed to universal health care for a very long time. Back in Arkansas, when Bill was first governor, I helped to come up with some ideas about how to expand healthcare into rural areas like Nelson County, where people don't have access to the doctors and the nurses. Now with telemedicine, with other kinds of advances, we can have more healthcare going out into rural areas. But if people can't pay for it, we still won't be able to provide what is needed. So I have been working on this for a long time, about, 27 years, and most obviously and publicly when Bill was first president. But I did not stop after we were unsuccessful. You know, I was one of the people who worked for the Children's Health Insurance Program, which has been a great boon to a lot of families that couldn't afford insurance for their children. We were able to expand coverage to, you know, about 6 million children. Well, now we want to expand it to more of the 9 million children who still don't have health insurance. And remember, these are not the poorest children, because those children go into Medicaid. These are children in working families. They have one or both parents who get up in Nelson County or get up in upstate New York and go to work but cannot afford insurance and don't have an employer to provide it. And so the Democrats, now that we have the majority in Congress, want to expand this program on a bipartisan basis. We have a lot of support from Republicans. The president has threatened to veto it. That really illustrates the philosophical, ideological, partisan divide. But I don't think people are going to be satisfied with that kind of politics anymore. We have a real problem. We have millions of children, and unfortunately, those children are suffering, and some are dying because they don't have access to insurance, except at the very end they go to the emergency room. And I don't think that's the kind of country we want. So we're going to pass this Children's Health Insurance Program extension. If the president wants to veto it, there could not be a clearer example of the difference in values between what we're trying to do and what he's doing.
I'm just curious. I read somewhere that as president, you get to appoint like every foreign ambassador. Is that true?
Where do you want to go? There are some good choices out there, John.
Well, I'm glad you cut right to it. I was kind of curious. Is it true that the U.S. Embassy in France is on the Champs-Élysées in Paris with a beautiful building with a...
Do you speak French?
I could.
Yeah, the French get a little bit out of sorts if we send somebody who can't speak their language. I'm not ruling it out. Ruling it out.
Well, I mean, everybody else is going to be asking before long. I could go ahead and start now.
That's right. Well, yeah.
Paris or Rome? Can I put we'll plug in for those two?
Sure, I'll just add you to the list.
I don't want to see that list. I mean, I met a lady one time who had just been appointed, I don't know if it was by your husband or by somebody else, as the U.S. ambassador to Slovenia. And she was excited about it, but trying to learn Slovenian is not something, you know. She wasn't too excited about it, so that's what I'd probably get, was Slovakia or something.
But we need you there. part of the challenge will be, and I've said this to a lot of people, that I'm not even going to wait till I'm inaugurated. I mean, after I'm elected, I'm going to ask... I'm going to ask distinguished Americans of both parties to head out around the world and go visit leaders and go make public appearances in as many countries as we can reach with a very simple message. The era of cowboy diplomacy is over.
I was going to ask you, while ago we were talking about our perception in the world, I was going to ask you, what's the first thing you're going to do when you get elected or when you take office to try to, reverse this wave of anti-Americanism around the world?
Well, I'm going to do what I just said, because I think it's important to let people know that the America that is still needed to lead the world is going to be reaching out again. You know, the policies of the last 6.5 years have alienated our friends and emboldened our enemies. And that has very serious consequences for our country and the world. So repairing it is not going to be easy. You can't just point your finger and say, oh, we're going to do this and that'll make a difference. It's painstaking, but it can be done. You know, diplomacy is often frustrating and from the outside looks as slow as molasses running uphill in the wintertime. I mean, it just doesn't look like it moves at all. But if you stay with it, it does begin to thaw out and you can try to bring people to some common ground. Now, we've got some real threats and dangers. Obviously, an emboldened Iran is one of the results of the Bush doctrine and policy as it's been implemented. But it's not the only danger that we confront. And I think the very first thing has to begin by paying attention to what the state of the situation is in Iraq. I believe that despite Senator Webb's best efforts and what I and others have tried to do, the president seems determined to stay on his course in Iraq until the last day he's in office. We don't know what we will inherit at the end of the next 15 months, but I have said that if the president does not extricate us from Iraq before he leaves office, when I'm president, I will, starting on the very first day, to bring people together. But we cannot be just focused on any one country or any one problem. You know, I have been somewhat bewildered by the president's refusal to have more diplomatic efforts going on simultaneously. You know, I was in Iraq and Afghanistan last January. And in Afghanistan, I saw how really concerned President Karzai was because there were all these problems with President Musharraf in Pakistan. And then when I saw President Musharraf later the same day, he had the same problems. So when I got back, I called the White House and I said, you know, I think it would make sense to appoint a high-level presidential envoy to basically shuttle back and forth. We don't want any misunderstandings. We want Afghanistan and Pakistan working together with respect to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. But that is just not the kind of effort that this White House believes in. So we've seen us lose ground in Latin America. You know, when my husband left office, there was only one country, Cuba, that wasn't a democracy. Now we've had authoritarian regimes and anti-Americanism come back in Latin America. We have the ongoing conflict in Sudan and other problems in Africa. We certainly are looking at a deteriorating situation in the Middle East with greater danger to Israel, with Iran, you know, supporting both Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. I mean, there are so many problems. So my highest priority will begin to unwind our involvement in Iraq because I think that is key to rebuilding our relationships and trying to have a more realistic view of what we have to do going forward. But I'll also be paying attention to every part of the world, and once again, trying to send out talented Americans who can begin to repair those relations. And there'll be an opportunity for you if you are so inclined.
I'm not leaving Charlottesville. Yeah. Much too happy. But speaking of jobs, though, what's Bill going to do?
Well, I think he will continue the work he's doing now with his foundation and this exciting effort, the Clinton Global Initiative, to sort of change the way philanthropy is done, bring more people to the table to come up with ideas that are creative and actually solve problems, which is his main passion. But he will also be one of those people who represents our country. He's incredibly popular around the world, and his foundation works on every continent doing something. And so he will be a goodwill ambassador or a special envoy because we're going to need everybody. We're going to need people who are in business and people who are in academia. We're going to have a lot of work for Americans to do, and he has said he will serve his country, which I think is what he's always tried to do, and I will certainly put him to work doing just that, because nobody could do it better.
Just a couple more, then we'll open it up to the floor. In the next 10 years, during your term, during your administration, between 30% and 40% of our school teachers are going to retire.
Right.
What are you going to do about it?
Well, we're going to, number one, start demonstrating greater respect for what teachers do every single day. It is... It is unfortunate but easy to understand that one of the reasons we have a teacher shortage is because we have a respect shortage. And I think it's time that we made teachers partners in all the reform efforts that we have to do. I am a very strong proponent of trying to figure out what schools should look like today. You know, if you go into a school today, and I do all the time, other than maybe a computer or computer lab, they look pretty much the same as they did when I was in school. Nothing else looks the same. We don't shop the same way. We don't communicate the same way. We don't work the same way. We don't live the same way. But our schools are still reflecting a time that is not any longer of the moment. And I know we're very conservative with our children. We don't want to take chances with our children. But I'm afraid that our failure to really think through how education should look in the 21st century is doing a disservice to our children. And therefore, I hope we can do a couple of things. I am a strong believer in preschool education. We need to have universal pre-kindergarten for children. I even advocate starting earlier with nurse visiting programs and volunteer programs. This is work that I've done going back 35 years and did a lot of it in Arkansas. How do we help a family understand they are their child's first school, and parents and other adults in that family that they are their child's first teacher? How do we give them the tools and the opportunity to do just that? And then in an organized way, a quality pre-kindergarten program is absolutely essential to better preparing kids from disadvantaged backgrounds or where English is not the first language in the home to be successful in school. You know, a Nobel Prize-winning economist at the University of Chicago looked at all the data and came out with what was a startling conclusion to people who don't usually follow early childhood development, but which I thought made a lot of sense. That a quality pre-kindergarten program would cut by 50% the achievement gap between African American and white children at the end of high school. Because if we can get kids in school earlier and sort of light that spark of both learning and those habits of discipline, that will equip a child. But the problem is, what is the school that we're having the child go to? How do we re-engineer or re-envision what our schools should look like? I think we've got to do a lot more with independent learning. I mean, children who have, you know, access to computers are on the computer all the time. You know, for better or worse, they're on the computer all the time. And that is a learning experience. How can we better harness it? At the same time, a veteran teacher once told me that after having taught for, I think it was 38 years, the big difference between kids today and kids when she started is she said that kids come today like they have a little remote control changer in their head because they're so used to being stimulated all the time. And so they are like turning the channels on what the teacher is saying. So we've got to support teachers. We have to recruit teachers. I'd like to see more loan forgiveness for people who go into teaching so that when they finish their college education, they can pay off their loans, particularly if they go into areas of real shortage like math and science and foreign language and so many of the other areas that we don't have adequate teaching force in. I'd like to see more mid-career programs so that people coming out of the military or ending a business career but want to teach are welcomed into our schools. We just have to have a tremendous effort undertaken where teachers are literally not just at the table, it is their table, where they say, look, here's what will work, because they're the ones with our children And they're the ones who have a better idea of what can light that spark of learning, and we need to support our teachers and recruit more teachers for what will be the challenge of the 21st century, how we prepare our children to compete in a world where it is not taken for granted that we're going to win the competition. You know, we are competing against countries we never competed against before who are hungry. They want to raise their standard of living. They want to give the millions and millions of young people a chance at a better life, and so our children had better be better prepared, and we're not yet, I think, on the right track to do that. Thank you.
If I don't ask this question, Renee's going to shoot me, okay? A lot is written about your wardrobe, your hair.
Yes, I know.
Your jewelry.
Yes.
If you're having a bad day, then they write about it. But if one of the boys is having a bad day, then it's no big deal.
I'm glad you noticed that.
Is there a double standard?
Well, I know that there is certainly a great deal of attention paid to women in politics on all of the grounds that John just addressed. And it's just part of the landscape that you live in. And you just have to grin and bear it, because I don't think it's going away anytime soon. And it is an affliction of every woman that I've ever met anywhere in the world who has been in public life. During my time in the White House, I used to travel extensively, I think to 82 countries for our country, and I would meet with women leaders everywhere. And it didn't matter if we were in Latin America or Africa or Asia or Europe, the talk would come around to the fact that, you know, it is a little bit more challenging because of all of these expectations. I think that's fading to some extent, and it certainly has not disappeared. But after a while, you just do the best you can. And you know, I don't know a woman who has never had a bad hair day. So I think that's a bonding experience for us, and we should look at it like that. But it is certainly something I have to pay more attention to than any of the men I'm running against. That doesn't have to be on their schedule, like, you know.
Is it kind of fun being the only girl in the race?
Well, there are moments, yeah. I have to say that, everywhere I go, I tell people that I'm thrilled at the prospect of breaking that glass ceiling and being the first woman president in our country. It's very exciting to me. And I'm not running because I'm a woman. I'm running because I think I'm the best qualified and experienced person to do the job, to hit the ground running in January 2009. But I have to say, when I go to these very large events that we're holding from, you know, New Hampshire to Nevada, it is so touching to me. Two things happen nearly every time. You know, I'll speak to 2,500 people in the skating rink in Pahrump, Nevada, which is an hour outside of Las Vegas in the desert, or in a gymnasium in Manchester, New Hampshire. And after I finish, you know, I go out and into the crowd and shake hands with people. And so many mothers and fathers have brought their children, particularly their daughters. And so as I meet the parents and maybe lean over to say hello to the little girl, as I'm moving on, I hear the mother or the father lean over and say, "See, honey, you can do whatever you want to do in life." And I always get touched by that, because that's what, you know, what my parents told me. And back, in the 1950s, that wasn't as obvious as I think it is today. But the other thing that happens is the number of women in their 90s who are coming to my event. And the first time this happened, I was so taken aback because this woman had been brought by her daughter and her granddaughter. And she'd been standing in this crowd for, 2 hours probably. And as I was going along shaking hands, she grabbed my hand and she said, "I am 95 years old. I was born before women could vote, and I'm going to live long enough to see a woman in the White House." Wow. And, wow. So I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen.
Let's open it up for questions. Who's got the microphones?
Here we go.
Maybe people could come out into the aisle. Is that easier? I'm going to stand up so I can
see
everybody.
Why don't you walk around? Yeah. Let me shut up for a while.
Didn't John do a good job?
Thank you.
And I really want to thank John and Renee. I don't know where Renee is in this crowd, but I want to thank John and Renee. Thank you so much, Renee. Thank you. Okay. Shall we start here?
All right, Hillary.
Yes.
I'm Colleen. I'm from Northern Virginia, and you were saying that you wanted to take our forces out of Iraq when you become president. And I was wondering what you would see Iraq looking like after we left.
Well, I don't think any of us can predict. I don't believe that we have, at this point, any good options. And I believe that our military has done everything we asked them to do. They were asked to get rid of Saddam Hussein and bring him to justice, and they did. And they were asked to give the Iraqis the chance for fair and free elections, and they did. And then they were asked to give the Iraqi government the space and time to make the political decisions that have to be made to stabilize Iraq. There is no military solution. This is a sectarian civil war where individuals and groups are jockeying for advantage, for position, political, religious, commercial. And there is no unifying leader or movement that has emerged that can sort of overcome these differences. I have said that we need to get our troops out of the middle of that sectarian civil war. They're acting as referees. But there are some continuing missions that I think are important. It is important that we go after Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And we've made some progress in Al Anbar province. There's been some tactical successes that have occurred in the last months. And I think that should be a remaining mission. We do have to protect our civilians and our embassy in Iraq. If the Iraqis begin to show more resolve and really pull themselves together as a government, there will be a continuing opportunity for us to train the Iraqi military. Distinguished retired American Marine General Jim Jones has just come with a report from his commission about how to do that. And I have said that I think we have an obligation to the Kurds who have sort of worked to get their country or their part of the country stabilized. And I think it's in our interest to prevent there from being any hostilities with Turkey or for the Iranians to continue to bombard the Kurds. So those are some of the missions. Now, despite the success of the American military, we know the Iraqi government has not fulfilled its part of the bargain, but neither has the Bush administration. And they have not pursued the diplomatic effort with the urgency it demanded. And I don't know that they've really come to grips with how complex it will be to withdraw. Withdrawing troops is a dangerous undertaking. You don't just wake up in the morning and start withdrawing 160,000 troops. And in addition, we have all of our civilian employees, our contractors. We have many Iraqis who sided with us, our translators, drivers, and others. We have so many millions of Iraqis who have been displaced internally and externally into other countries. So the question is one that can't really be answered with any certainty. There is a great deal of uncertainty, and we've got to begin to plan much more effectively as to how to deal with the many different contingencies that, unfortunately, I think we're going to face. And that is what I've been trying to focus on, and that is what I will try to do when I'm president.
My name's Ann Krieger. I'm a public school teacher in Nelson County. And I appreciate what you said earlier about your vision for education. But I still have some great concerns. Our CEO president seems to think that education can be run like a business. And I've heard it once said that childhood should be a journey, not a race. I feel that all we public school teachers do anymore, instead of teaching and finding creative opportunities for learning, is we test and we analyze data.
Right.
Can you comment, please, on No Child Left Behind?
Well, I agree that the president's signature policy, the No Child Left Behind policy, has not done what many of us hoped it would do. It has produced some positive changes, but in general, it is an unfunded mandate, and it has created an emphasis on testing that has crowded out so much of the rest of the curriculum, that has undermined the discretion that schools and individual teachers should have in trying to work with individual students. There are so many problems with the way No Child Left Behind has been implemented. And I think that it is important that we begin by trying to reform that, which we are attempting to do. I don't know how much we could get done with the president, because he is very wedded to this policy. But I would like to look at what we were on the road to doing when my husband was president, when we had something called Goals 2000, where we set goals. And I think we need to set goals for education in our country, education at the state level, the local level, the school level, the class level. But we need to unleash the energy, the dynamism, the creativity of teachers and students in meeting those goals. I don't think it's in the best interests of our children that they're being denied recess and physical education and art and music and all kinds of programs. And we need to pay attention to the whole child, if you will. Children learn differently. You know, children learn by doing, and we don't have a lot of experiential learning left in the classroom because everybody's being drilled to take tests. Children learn through aesthetic experiences. You know, teaching a child to play an instrument may be the best way to get a child to care about or be interested in math. I mean, there's so many parts of this. Our country did, I think, pretty well during most of the 20th century with a public school system where everybody came and where, you know, we had a real diversity of experience. And now we are struggling to make sure that our education system prepares our children for the 21st century. But I think we can do that in a more child-centered, effective way than what we currently are doing. And so I look forward to a real partnership. Now, I don't want to leave any children behind. I'll tell you, there's a little insight into this. My first job out of law school was working for the Children's Defense Fund. And and I worked for it, and then I was on the board, and I chaired the board all those years. It was a great experience, and I helped to gather evidence that led to special education laws being passed and bringing more children into school and all the rest of it. But our slogan was Leave No Child Behind. So you can imagine my surprise when then Governor Bush started talking about No Child Left Behind. And I thought, that's terrific. You know, that's what it means to be a compassionate conservative. He's going to embrace the Children's Defense Fund agenda. And I was quickly disabused of that. So I think we can do better. And I look forward to working with teachers like yourself. And thank you for teaching. I think there's a microphone.
One button right there.
Okay.
Hi, Senator Clinton. My name's Elizabeth Epps. I'm from here in Charlottesville. And I see on the slogan change in experience, and I've heard you speak and differentiate yourself one of the ways from Senator Obama being the issue of experience. And my question is a simple one. Do you feel that Senator Obama has enough experience to be vice president, and will you invite him to join you on your ticket?
Well, You know, I think this is one of the best elections that certainly the Democratic Party has had. Because we have a field of really great candidates. You don't have to be against anybody. You can be for whomever you choose. And I have the highest regard for all of my opponents. And, you know, I can't think about anything like that because that's like a jinx. You know, it's like talking about a no-hit game. You don't want that to happen. But I, you know, assuming I can win the nomination, I will give, you know, serious thought to, you know, to him and to others who I think will bring a great deal, not only to the ticket, which is the political side of the equation, but much more importantly, to governing our country and to, once again, lifting us up and setting some goals and bringing people together to achieve them. So, you know, if I get there next spring, that's what I'm going to be focused on. Thank you.
I'm a little bored back there.
Okay. Yes, this young man right there.
My name is Matthew Descano, and when you're elected, what's your husband going to be called, like the first gentleman?
Well, that's a good idea. As you might guess, we've gotten lots of suggestions. And, you know, first mate, that was proposed. Some of Bill's friends in Scotland said, how about first laddie? I think, though, that probably he'll still be called Mr. President because he was our president for 8 years. But it is an interesting question because it's never happened before. And having served as president, he has great insight into how our political system works and I think will be incredibly helpful. Now, as far as I know, having read history and having known, you know, a number of our recent presidents and first ladies, every couple has talked to one another nonstop. Because there really is only one person that you feel totally you can have a confidential, you know, discussion with. And so I'm going to rely on my husband. I'll still call him Bill for a lot of good advice. But thank you for your question.
Let's go. We're two up there. One okay. Time.
Okay. Yes.
Hello. I was wondering, as a college student, the issue of college affordability has become a huge issue across the country, and I wanted to know if you had any plans for addressing the issue for paying for a higher education.
Absolutely, and I have a little bit of good news about this, because the cost of college had gone up consistently higher than the rate of inflation, and every crowd that I talk with, when I say we have to make college affordable again, people stand up and cheer because it isn't. It is now more expensive for a student of middle income or modest means to afford to go to college than it was 30 years ago. In part, that's due to the increase in the interest rates on student loans. You know, when I was going to college, my father said he had enough money saved to pay for room, board, and tuition. But if I wanted to buy a book, I had to pay for it myself. And that was our deal. And then I decided that I wanted to go to law school, and I told my father, and he said, well, that was not part of the deal. So I had to keep working, which was fine because I'd done that for years. And I got a little scholarship, and then I borrowed money. And I borrowed money from the federal government, something called the National Defense Education Act, which was passed when Sputnik went up in order to encourage more young Americans to go to college and make it affordable. And I don't remember the exact interest rate, but it was like 2%. I mean, it was not at all burdensome. And fast forward to today, where so many people feel like they can't afford to start or finish college. Well, 2 weeks ago, the new Democratic Congress passed a sweeping overhaul of education funding, lowering the interest rates on student loans, increasing the amount of Pell Grants, and looking for more ways to help students afford to go to college and graduate. So we're making progress. I think there's more work to be done. And as president, It'll be one of my highest education priorities, because what's happened is if you're a student from the top 25% of income in America, even if you're in the bottom 25% of academic achievement, you will go to college. But if you're a student from the top 25% of academic achievement, but the bottom 25% of income, it is now much harder for you to afford to go to college. That is not the way America should work. We need to open the doors of college and great institutions like UVA and others to as many students from as many diverse backgrounds as possible. If you go and look at a lot of the top flight schools now, much of their student body comes from a similar economic strata that was not the case in previous generations. And so we've got to figure out how we're going to begin to open the doors again from really decent, hardworking young people who deserve to go to college. And that is one of my very strongest priorities.
Hello, Ms. Clinton. First of all, thank you for being here. My name is Giancarlo Anini. I am a student at UVA, and I am a dual citizen. I'm actually half American, half Nicaraguan. So as you see, when you speak about Latin America and how the United States has become into trouble in Latin America, I understand. And my main question is, will the United States retake an active role in Latin America? Because foreign policy in Latin America seems to be managed by third-ranking officers and secretaries of state, and that has caused much trouble in Nicaragua and in the rest of Latin America.
Well, thank you very much for your question and your comment. I intend to make Latin America a centerpiece of my foreign policy. And there are a number of reasons for that. Number one, we are in the same hemisphere, and it is important that we deepen our relationships and look for ways that we can cooperate and work together on a range of issues, from global warming to economic development to the struggle against drug trafficking and so much else. Secondly, we know that Latin America, as the gentleman alluded to, has moved away from the United States. And there's a lot of discouragement about democracy and free markets. And for some legitimate reasons, the benefits did not really get to the people in general. You know, that's one of the reasons I voted against the Central America Free Trade Agreement, because it didn't have any standards that I thought would actually translate the benefits of trade into an improving standard of living for the people who were doing the work in the countries that would be affected. I thought it might very well lead to even greater economic benefits to the elite in those countries, you know, who would buy more apartments in New York or in Miami, but it wouldn't necessarily educate the children or give them health care in the countries where they were from. And we've got to work with the governments to the south to try to come up with ways we can encourage and support them in creating economic opportunities for their own people. You know, we know we're facing a very controversial political issue about immigration. And I think we need comprehensive immigration reform. And I hate seeing the immigration issue demagogued. I don't think that is appropriate, and it doesn't answer the problems that we face. But if you look at comprehensive immigration reform, it is border security. It is, you know, sanctioning employers who employ people who are not here legally. It is giving more help to local communities, and it is providing a pathway to legalization for the people who are here after they pay fines, pay their taxes, learn English, wait in line, they can't jump the line. But it is also looking to see what we can do to stem the tide of immigration. People would not leave their homes, their families, their villages if they thought they could make a decent living in the home where they come from. Unfortunately, they do not believe that, and there is very little that gives them a sense that if they were to stay, that the situation would change. So I think that the United States has to have a partnership with Latin America, has to look for ways through microfinancing, through infrastructure projects, through outreach of all kinds, to try to create more economic opportunity throughout Latin America. This is a long-term solution, but you know, some of the countries are seeing good growth. That's encouraging to me. but the growth needs to be more broadly spread in order to lift the standard of living and the educational levels of a lot of the people who are, you know, living there and looking for a better opportunity. So I think that we need to pay a lot of attention to Latin America, and I intend to do so at the highest levels of my administration.
This can go on all day. Do you want to take 1 or 2 minutes?
Yeah, why don't we take a couple more?
We have time for 2 more.
Okay. So, okay, right there.
Thank you. The Bush administration has been engaging in a major power grab as they strive towards this concept that they call the unitary presidency.
Right.
Including signing statements.
Right.
Assuming that you're the next president of the United States, do you intend to give back some of those ill-gotten gains like to the other two components of our government? And also, how would that look if you did that?
I think it's a very serious issue. And it is something that is debated in law school classes and in the Congress. But it may not be yet at the level of national attention that it deserves to be. I think there is no doubt that the president, and particularly the vice president, and many of their allies in the government and outside, have made a concerted effort to radically change our constitutional system of government without amending the Constitution, but rather using the power of the presidency on a range of issues to undermine the separation of powers and the checks and balances of our tripartite system. You mentioned signing statements. That's a perfect example. Now, signing statements have been used by previous presidents, but not in the way that they're being used by this president. In previous times, a signing statement that would go along with a president signing a piece of legislation would explain how it would be executed, might say, well, there is an apparent conflict between this legislation and another bill that will be worked out in the following way. They were more explanatory. What this president has done is to use it as a line item veto, in effect, which is not constitutional according to the United States Supreme Court. I'll give you one example from my own experience. I was very proud of the independent expertise of FEMA when my husband was president. It worked. People looked to it for not only help in an emergency, but to mitigate and prepare for emergencies. I think it was a mistake, and I said so at the time, to move FEMA into the new Department of Homeland Security where it was lost. And we saw most tragically the results along the Gulf Coast. So I tried to make FEMA independent again. I wasn't successful on that, but I did pass legislation saying, it's kind of sad you had to say this, but saying that the director of FEMA should have experience in handling emergencies. That's part of this really old-fashioned idea I have that you appoint qualified people for the positions they hold in the government. And, you know, we voted for it. It passed. When the president signed the larger bill it was a part of, in a signing statement, he said he might or might not abide by that. So on large matters having to do with habeas corpus, military commissions, so much else, or on matters that are very specific like that, this president has used signing statements to undermine the will and authority of the actions that Congress takes. So yes, we do have to make dramatic changes. How would it look? Well, I think it would begin to return to a respect for the Constitution and the separation of powers that has been lost by this president and vice president. We didn't know whether to laugh or cry when the vice president said he was part of some heretofore never discovered fourth branch of government in refusing to turn over documents that were lawfully requested. And it becomes almost by just action after action, people become desensitized to the very real threat to the way our government operates. You know, one of the geniuses of the founders is how much they knew about human nature. You know, they were actually pretty smart psychologically in the way they set up our system. You know, left to our own devices, and this is true about anybody, you know, people will push the envelope of power as far as they can unless they have the self-restraint and the discipline that, you know, should be expected in our leaders. And so the founders set up this check and balance system. And Vice President Cheney in particular has been working assiduously every day to try to change it. And so, yes, I take it seriously. I, you know, when I'm president, I take, you know, a vow to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America, and I take that very, very seriously, and I will do everything I can to reverse the undermining of our Constitution and our system of government that we've seen in the Bush administration. And I guess this will be the last one. Yes.
Hi, my name's Kyle. Thank you very much for coming tonight, or this afternoon. So I'm on the Youth Advisory Committee for the United States Public Service Academy, and you introduced that legislation, and Mr. Grisham asked a question, and he cited this statistic about 30% of our teachers retiring. And I was just kind of wondering what you're doing to advance that legislation within Congress and get it passed.
Kyle, thank you so much, and thanks for mentioning that. I'm very proud of this. This was an idea that two young men had, that they worked on and then began to shop it around Capitol Hill. So if you think you can't make a difference, here's an object lesson that indeed you can. I was so excited by their idea. Their idea, very simply, is this. We have superb military academies that provide a taxpayer-paid education for young men and women who want to become officers in our military. I think we need a public service academy that does the same, that says, you know, the work in the civilian workforce in the United States government is important. We have learned that because of Iraq. You know, there is no military solution, but where are the cadres of linguists and experts in everything from agriculture to constitution writing, you know, that can go out and do that work? Or where are the other public servants, you know, like teachers, police officers, firefighters, law enforcement, just the whole range of what we need? Because what John said about teachers retiring is true in our government. If you look at the age of the workforce in the United States government, in every part of the government, you know, from things that you think about a lot, maybe the State Department or the Treasury Department, or things that you might not think about that are very important, like the people who regulate nuclear reactors, the workforce is aging. And we're not bringing in a new generation of young people who are willing to do government service. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I'm looking for ways to create some excitement and some energy and some incentives. So I have a Republican co-sponsor, Senator Spector of Pennsylvania. And so it's bipartisan. And he and I announced it together, and we're working to get more sponsors, as are people like Kyle, who are behind this idea. And we're going to keep pushing and try to make progress. It might be step by step. But just as my husband was the author of AmeriCorps, which has done so much in our country, both to give young people a chance to serve, but also to go to college. I want to add this public service academy as an option, because I think we need a lot of different ideas that will catch the imagination of young Americans. Our country desperately needs you. You know, the young men and women who are serving in Iraq or Afghanistan are heroic and dedicated and some of the best young people that our country has ever produced. And I am proud to support them in every way I can, including trying to bring them home, because I think that is ultimately the best way to support them, by bringing them home from Iraq. But we could never have made the progress we made as a nation had we not had a commitment to public service from so many people who may never have served in the military, but did serve in our government. You know, in this part of America, so near to Washington, D.C., there are so many people who have made a contribution. They've helped to design AmeriCorps or, you know, deal with some of the challenges that we face in healthcare to create the Children's Health Insurance Program, you know, both on Capitol Hill and in the executive and the judiciary branch. But there's also work to be done out in the states and in local communities. So I'm going to work very hard while I'm a senator, and then we're hoping, Senator Spector and I, that we can, you know, make some progress. But when I'm president, it will be in my budget. It is something that I want people to rally around and to understand that we have to reinvigorate the idea of public service. Our country is premised on public servants, those who actually work for pay within our different levels of government, and those who are volunteers or in non-governmental organizations. That is one of the unique features that sets us apart from other nations. We've known about this going back to de Tocqueville, but you know, we've seen it in every generation of Americans. And I want to give the opportunity to serve to young people by giving them this education, then giving them a period of time when they will serve in return for their education, just like our graduates of the military academies do, and start a new cadre of Americans who understand that it is not just up to whom we elect and put into office. It is really all of our responsibility to make our country what we know it needs to be and what we believe in our hearts it should be. Thank you all very much. Thank you. That was so much fun.
Yeah,
then probably
tomorrow. Do it. Down here?
I don't think I can.
Okay.
I don't know.
Give us
this one. Okay.
Thank you all so much. No time for handshaking.
Well, we're so excited. This live call with 2,000 people.
Okay.